ever in Norfolk, please come see us. I believe the meeting gets better and better every week. My sobriety date is May 1st, 2004. I'm going to tell you a little bit about what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. I think I probably took my first drink. I remember because I just went down to Florida to see my girlfriend, and we actually took my first drink together. It was at a slumber party. It was in sixth grade, and we stole a can of beer from her mom's fridge, and I remember we drank half of it. We did not like the taste of it. We were the only two. I think there were like six girls there, and we were the only two that drank. They didn't want anything. And she ended up becoming one of my best drinking buddies. You know, I didn't like the taste of it. I didn't feel any different. My sister and my father were alcoholics, and I didn't understand why they drank the way they did. I saw the way that it hurt my family. I saw the way it hurt me. I didn't understand it. I didn't understand why they had to drink. I thought it was a choice, you know, at that point. I would find out later, though, that it was not a choice. And, you know, I didn't drink again until it was a couple years. One summer, my mom and stepfather had a 4th of July party. They bought a lot of beer, and nobody drank at the party. Probably 6 or 7 beers were missing from, I think they bought 4 cases. And so we had this little fridge out in the garage that was filled with beer. And by the end of the summer, there were maybe 6, 7, 8 beers left. And I blamed it on my friends. I blamed it on my sister. It was never me. I would go out at night and drink 1 or 2 beers. I don't remember getting drunk, but I do remember liking the way it made me feel. And I started to like the taste of it. I never, you know, I still didn't think that anything was wrong with that. You know, 14 years old and drinking alone on the porch. Good times. But, you know, I started drinking socially in my freshman year of high school. Going to the parties, drinking with the big boys, and thinking I was so cool. You know, all my girlfriends would be puking by the end of the night, and I would be the one holding their hair. You know, and just thinking, you know, God, I've got this thing under control. You know, I understand why my sister drinks now, but I'm not an alcoholic. I don't have a problem. I can control it. And, you know, during this time, my sister had been in and out of the program, in and out of AA, rehabs, detox, jails. And at this point, I think she had about 8 or 9 months sober. And I would go to meetings with her to support her. And I think she probably knew before I did that something was wrong, that there was a problem. And I would go to these meetings and I would listen to what they were saying, and I could relate to what they were saying. I didn't chalk it up as me being an alcoholic. I thought it was because I was the sister of an alcoholic. I thought it was because I was the daughter of an alcoholic, not because I was an alcoholic. And I would leave the meetings and go out drinking with my friends. And, you know, by the end of the night when they were puking, I would be like, you know, I think you might have a problem with alcohol. I can take you to a meeting. You know, as I'm sitting there drinking my 40 or whatever. It was never me. It was always them. And, you know, this went on and on. And I controlled it for a while. And I never knew. You know, of course, I dabbled in drugs. You know, I think I started out on drugs before I started drinking. And it was nice, but it was not alcohol. You know, it was just not alcohol. It was a good experience, but it didn't come close to alcohol. It didn't come close to touching it. You know, it was, I remember just always feeling different when I was in high school and in middle school, and even before I picked up a drink, just always feeling different, not like I belonged. And when I took that drink, everything changed. You know, I felt like I was funny, I was pretty, I was, you know, everybody liked me. I didn't need to worry about who liked me and who didn't, and I didn't need to worry about, you know, what I was saying or what I was doing or how I felt, because I always felt different. I always felt like something was missing. And I think I've heard a speaker say once, like they missed the class on the directions for life or something. You know, I always felt like that. Like I had been missing this chip that just knew how to live life. You know, and all through high school I felt this way. I was never involved in anything. I never, you know, I would start taking dance lessons or start, you know, a sport, but I would never finish it. You know, I never stuck with anything. And I think that probably helped me feel a little more different, you know, because all my friends were, you know, at soccer games, and I would go and watch and wish I could be part of it, but I never was. You know, and this was all through high school. And probably my junior or senior year, I started drinking every chance I could get. I think it was 2 days before my senior year started, a very good friend died in a car accident. He had been drinking and driving. And, you know, that summer, my best friend, the girl that I took my first drink with, we had been talking about how great this year was going to be. It's going to be the best year. We were really going to apply ourselves. We were going to get into a good college. And within the first month of school, she had been to rehab and then got sent away to boarding school. You know, so there goes my perfect senior year. And, you know, it was I was very resentful at that young man for a long time, you know, because it changed everything. It changed the way I thought. It changed the way I drank. It changed, you know, changed the course of my life. Maybe for a good way, but, you know, that year was probably the worst year. I missed so much school. I never wanted to go to school. Every chance I got, I would skip or leave early or come late, and I hated it. I hated the way that people looked at me. I hated eating lunch. I hated classes. I did not want to apply myself at all, and I didn't. And somehow I scraped by. Somehow I graduated, and I was just so happy to be out of there. But once I graduated, it was, you know, I had a job. I had been working since probably my sophomore year at the same job, and they knew me very well. So I could make my own hours, you know, and I started making my working hours around my drinking schedule. You know, I didn't go in early. I stayed late, you know, like 7 o'clock, and was able to drink around that schedule. And I took some college courses, and, of course, you know, they were either online courses or evening courses. Again, they didn't interfere with my drinking, and if they did, I ended up failing out of them. You know, and at this point, I had started drinking every day. You know, I had a boyfriend. He was a really good guy. He was a drug dealer. And he made you know, enough money to support our habits. And I was thinking about this on the way up. I mean, he would always buy the beer, and I would always drink it. You know, I would get so angry at him if he had, like, we got a 6-pack and he drank like 4 beers and I only got 2, because that's not enough. I might as well not drink, you know. And again, you know, drugs came into play there too. If I didn't get enough alcohol, I would substitute drugs. And you know, it was crazy. And all the while, my friends are like, "Why do you have to drink every day?" I mean, every day I was drinking, and I was, you know, 18, 19 years old. And they didn't understand it. I had to drink before we went to the club. I had to drink before we went to a concert or anywhere. You know, I mean, and if there wasn't alcohol there, I wasn't there. You know, if there wasn't enough alcohol at the party, I wasn't there either. Or I would bring my own stash and keep it in my purse. And I remember many times not putting in for alcohol and walking out with, like, 6 cans of beers in my purse. You know, it was just, I always had to, that was the first thought in my mind, how can I get enough, you know, to feel satisfied? And nobody got it, you know, that made me feel even more different, you know. The friends that I chose in the beginning, because they drank the way I did, they partied the way I did, they, you know, they were kind of dying down. And I was like, what's this about? This is not what I, you know, bought into. You know, and I'm still working, still going to a little bit of school. And I figured out that that there's something wrong here. It's probably my friends, you know, maybe it's that drug dealer boyfriend that I'm dating or have been dating. You know, so I decided to move down to Virginia Beach. you know, and I thought that that would be, that would really help. And I did that, and I made things a lot worse. My drinking picked up severely. You know, I didn't have any friends down here. And I had been going to school a little bit, and I wasn't working, so I had a lot of time on my hands. And I started drinking at home alone. And that's always fun. You know, I remember thinking, you know, I'm never going to drink in the morning. I'm never going to throw up and then drink again. I'm never going to drink at alone at home, you know. I'm never going to drink before going somewhere. And by this time, you know, I'd done, like, everything on that I'm never going to list. And, you know, I ended up spending, like, every 2 weeks I would either go up north to be with my boyfriend and my friends, or I would, they would come down here and spend the weekend or a few days. And, you know, I was so unsettled at this time. You know, I was in between, like, Northern Virginia and Virginia Beach all the time. And at this point, you know, my sister had, again, been in and out of AA, and she'd gotten a year together, a year sober. And she asked me and my mom to come to the her one-year anniversary to watch her pick up her medallion and maybe go out to eat afterwards with everyone. And I went to the meeting, and I watched her pick up her medallion, and I cried like a good little sister. And then directly after the meeting, I left and got drunk. You know, this was what my drinking was about. I stopped caring about my family. You know, the things that were most important to me did not matter anymore. I stopped caring. I had no goals. I had no dreams for life. All I could think about was how I was going to get my next drink. You know, and that was the most important thing on my mind. And if that meant hurting my sister, if that meant, you know, yelling at my mom, if that meant missing my niece's basketball game or, you know, soccer game or whatever, I would do it, you know, in a heartbeat, because alcohol always came first. And, I mean, this was, you know, countless times in my drinking that's what I did, you know. And around this time, I started realizing that maybe it wasn't Northern Virginia, maybe it wasn't the boyfriend, and I started, you know, tossing around the idea in my head about getting sober. And I told, I broke up with that boyfriend. Very sad. But I broke up with that boyfriend because I wanted to get sober, and I told him that, you know, and I wanted him to get sober with me, and he didn't want to. You know, he's making good money and all that good stuff. So we broke up, and you know, it was again, you know, I was alone, you know. I remember one day, one of the last times I drank, I went, I got grants for school from, you know, various sources, and I had a little bit of money left over, and I went to the liquor store, and I got the biggest, cheapest bottle of rum I could find. I mean, it was, like, huge. It was, like, this big for, like, $10. Disgusting. Yeah. And I went home, and it was, like, 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and I started drinking, and I didn't stop. You know, my mom got home at about 6:30, didn't stop. You know, and we were sitting there watching TV, and she was eating dinner, and I was just taking shots right there next to her, never thinking, you know, this might really be hurting her. You know, maybe I shouldn't do this. It didn't matter. It really didn't matter. And I didn't stop. That night I did throw up, and I started drinking again, you know, like a good alcoholic. And I remember talking to a friend that night, and I was wasted by the time I talked to him. I think it was about 11 o'clock at night. And he asked me what was going on, you know. He said, "This isn't you, Jody. What's going on?" And you know, I was like, well, this is the new me. You know, this is it. it wasn't me, you know. In a few short years, I mean, I was practically, you know, you wouldn't even recognize me. And I had no idea what I was doing. That weekend I went up to Northern Virginia so sick, so hungover. And it was a Saturday night, and I went out with all my old friends, we had a house party or something, and I was just sitting there watching everybody drink. And that I did that for a few hours, and just thinking, God, this is ridiculous. You know, look at how stupid they're acting. You know, I don't want to do this. But I drank anyways. I drank anyways. And I had a few beers and a few shots, and I didn't feel anything. I didn't feel anything at all, and I was pissed. I was really upset about that, you know, because I didn't. I drank, you know, men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. It wasn't producing that effect anymore. And I didn't understand that either. And so I went home the next day, I think, and I just knew it was over. I knew it, you know. And I went to our local intergroup office and picked up a meeting list just in case AA might work for me. You know, at this point, I tried pretty much everything else. I tried therapy. I tried drugs. I tried therapy and drugs. I tried, you know, moving away. I tried different boyfriends. I tried different friends. Different schools, and none of it worked, you know. So AA, you know, I really wanted to go to rehab, but my insurance company would not let me. So I went to AA instead, and I'm really grateful for that. Really grateful for that. The first meeting I went to, it was a 6 p.m. meeting right down the road from my house. And this particular church has about 4 or 5 meetings a day. And I was really lucky for that early in sobriety. It was literally like 6 minutes from my house, and it was perfect. You know, I didn't venture out from that church. Probably in the first like 5 months of sobriety, I went to only meetings at that church. There was one at 11 o'clock in the morning. There was one at 6, one at 8, one at 10:30 or 11 at night. So that first meeting I went to, I remember sitting in the parking lot so scared, just sitting in my car, you know, thinking, God, this is going to be rough. You know, they'll probably kick me out, tell me I'm too young, I'm not an alcoholic. But I went in, and there was a greeter there. He met me at the coffee pot, and he said, "Welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. My name's Ralph." And thank God for that. Thank God for that. Still to this day, he remembers my name, you know. And that, I think the greeter is probably the most important position in any home group, you know, because without that guy standing there, you know, welcoming me, I probably would have run away, you know, and not come back. But, you know, I stayed, and it was a commuter meeting, so there was a bunch of, you know, older people. Getting off of work, talking about, like, work-life problems, like, you know, kids and losing families, and I didn't have any of that, you know. I was like, I never lost anything. I never got a DUI. I didn't lose my house or my family. And somebody pointed out to me, "Well, you didn't have anything to lose, Jody." And I said, "Oh, you're right, I didn't." you know, and that was a good point. And they told me to listen to what was being shared, listen to how people felt, because that was more important than what they'd done, you know. And I did listen to that, and I heard exactly how I felt. I thought, you know, for years I'd been alone, and finally coming to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and being ready to hear, you know, to hear that message, and hearing exactly how I felt, and what everybody was saying. And I am... You know, they talked about, you know, getting a sponsor, getting a home group, working steps, getting a service position. And I didn't know, you know, what all of this meant, but I did it because I was so desperate. You know, I was so, at that point, I mean, I was willing to do anything. Anything anybody told me to do, I would do it. Because I didn't, you know, I didn't have anything else. I was so broken. And, you know, I did that. I got a home group. I got the 10:30 p.m. group as my home group. It was, you know, that's like the time when I started getting ready to go out, or I'd start drinking most of the time. And it was perfect for me. You know, I got out at 11:30. I only had a half hour, you know, until I couldn't buy liquor anymore. And so I'd stick around after the meeting sometimes and help clean up or smoke a cigarette or just talk. And that, you know, that was perfect for me. And that worked. You know, I ended up opening that meeting. It met like 5 days a week. And so I ended up opening that meeting one night a week. And so I had a key to the church. And I was so amazed that anybody would trust me with anything. You know, they trusted me to put the money in the safe at the end of the night. They trusted me with the key. I remember being so like, Mom, they gave me a key to a church. This is amazing. You know, and just, you know, I did that. And I remember so many times, like, thinking at 10 o'clock, you know, or 9:30, thinking, God, I really don't want to go open this meeting, but I have to, you know. And that's, like, today I stress the importance of having a service position to my sponsees or to anybody coming in new, because that saved my butt so many times, you know, knowing that people were counting on me to be there. You know, I know they probably would have had an extra key, probably would have opened the church anyways, but it was, you know, important for me to feel that way, you know, that somebody was counting on me. And, you know, I did that for a few months, and then I realized that there were, like, meetings outside of that church. You know, Virginia Beach, Norfolk, Portsmouth, there's a lot of different meetings. And I started branching out and hearing really a different message. You know, it's, you get a 10:30 p.m. meeting, you get some interesting characters, and, you know, I started hearing a different message. You know, I started hearing a solution when I went out to those other meetings. And I got, I remember seeing this woman at a couple meetings, and she was laughing and smiling and talking to everybody, and she, you know, everybody knew her name, and at this point, you know, I could, it was hard enough for me to, like, stay after a meeting and smoke a cigarette, maybe say hi to somebody, one or two people. You know, and I wanted that. I wanted to be able to remember names, first of all, and I wanted to learn how to small talk, because I had never socialized without alcohol in my system, you know. Then I was funny, and I was loud, and I was, you know, all that stuff, and drinking, I had no idea who I was. And I ended up asking her to be my sponsor, and she taught me a lot of stuff. She taught me about the socializing stuff. She made me go to parties, or she made me go out to eat after the meetings, to get out there, to put my hand out there so people would get to know me. And I never, you know, I never wanted to do it, but I did it. And, you know, we worked the steps, and I got a lot out of her. Wake up, Kate. and I got a lot from her, you know. She taught me a lot, and she kind of, I mean, at that point in my drinking, I had stopped trusting anybody, you know, especially women. And that relationship with her helped me to trust women again. It helped me to open up and to be open to that, you know, to be open to new relationships and stuff. And it was nice. It was really nice. You know, around this time, about 6 months sober, I think, one of my friends that I had met through the program had started talking about a young people's meeting that was in Norfolk. And now I'd never been to a meeting in Norfolk. That's a little scary. You know, I just started, like, managing Virginia Beach, you know, knowing my way around Virginia Beach and stuff. And, you know, he was like, it's worth it. It's worth it. You know, come out there. It's a really good meeting. It's just starting up. And literally it started up, like, you know, a month ago at that point. It's now been about 2 years. So I went to that home group, or I went to that group, and I made it my home group. And it's been so awesome to watch it grow. I mean, 2 years, a lot has changed. You know, we started out as a daily reflection meeting, and we're now a big book topic meeting. So that's been really cool to see the group members evolve and find their program, you know, find a solution in the big book and stuff. And that's been pretty awesome. And, you know, I just did what I was told. You know, I started hearing, through hanging out with this guy and another guy, they were talking a lot about the big book, and I had not gone through the steps out of the big book. And I wanted that. I wanted what they were talking about. They were talking about, you know, a spiritual awakening, and although I felt different from working the steps with this first sponsor, I wanted what they had, you know. But there weren't a lot of women in that area that had worked the steps out of the big book, at least in Virginia Beach. And I wanted that, and I was searching for that, you know. And I didn't find it until I went to this workshop in Portsmouth, a day of sharing type thing. And there was a woman sharing on self-centered fear. And at that point, I knew, I mean, I was right. I was right there in the middle of self-centered fear, not unable to move, so scared, you know, not knowing what to do with it. I talked over, you know, talked with my sponsor about it, and I couldn't get out of it. And I remember wanting to speak with her, you know, wanting to tell her my experience and talk to her and thank her for sharing. But after she had shared, there was, you know, a gaggle of women, like, just flocked to her. And I was so scared. I was like, no, she, you know, she's too busy. I just won't say anything to her. And my friend Ryan came up to me after the meeting and was like, you know, come on, I'm going to introduce you to your new sponsor. And he went over there and introduced me to this woman, and she's my sponsor now. And she, you know, after talking, I shared a little bit about what was going on, and you know, she was like, can we go through the big book? And I said, yes, let's go through the big book. And I was really excited about that. I mean, she was just what she shared in that one, I think she shared for 40 minutes, and I mean, I could just relate to everything she said, you know, and I'd never heard a solution like that from a woman, and I wanted what she had, definitely. And we started working together, and, you know, she told me she was going to take me through the big book page by page. We would go through each chapter, and I was really excited. You know, I'd been reading the big book on my own, and I was just really excited to hear what she had to say about it. And we started with the doctor's opinion, and that was perfect. You know, I knew I was an alcoholic, but I didn't know exactly what an alcoholic was. And the doctor's opinion told me that, you know, told me about the obsession, and I never knew that was an obsession. You know, I never knew that I didn't have a choice in the matter, you know. It told us about the craving, too. And I always thought, I remember thinking, you know, like, after a long night of drinking, waking up the next morning and being so sick and hungover and saying, I'm not going to drink today. I am not going to drink today. And by 6 o'clock, I was getting ready to go out drinking again, you know, and not understanding. You know, I never knew. I just thought I just changed my mind. I never knew I had a decision. I mean, I never knew I didn't have a choice in the matter, you know. And that, you know, that was the way my drinking was, you know. And the craving, I didn't know I couldn't have just one or two beers. I didn't know I had to get totally obliterated and, you know, not remember anything or act like a fool. I didn't know, you know. And the doctor's opinion told me a lot about alcoholism. We went through more about alcoholism, and there was a solution, and I saw hope, you know. I saw hope. And Bill's story, oh, I remember reading that the first time and hated it. I hated it. But when I went through it with my sponsor, you know, it was a totally different experience than just reading it by myself. You know, I saw a lot of me and what he, you know, talked about and what he, how he felt and the things that he did, not necessarily exactly what he did, but, you know, I could relate. You know, we agnostics, I didn't think I had a problem with God. You know, and I didn't think that chapter really applied to me. I didn't think I was going to get anything out of it, but it speaks to me still today, you know, anytime I read it. And it doesn't matter what I read in there, I always get something different out of it. And it's just, I mean, that's got to be one of my favorite chapters in the big book. It has so much information jam-packed in there. And, you know, going on to how it works, the third step, you know, I was ready, you know. Reading all this stuff, going over it with my sponsor and everything, I was ready to take some action. I needed something to change. We said the third step prayer, and I didn't feel any different. And I thought, spiritual awakening? No, not so much. You know, and we got right into the fourth step. We got into the inventory. And I was really excited about this, you know, because I'd heard awesome things about the fourth step. I'd done a fourth step before, but I think I had like 6 months sober. And there was a lot of stuff that I hadn't seen yet, a lot of stuff I wasn't willing to look at. And by this time, I think I had a year and a half sober. The fog had lifted a lot, and I was ready to go. And we did that fourth step, and she had me do the resentments. She had me do the fear inventory. She had me do the conduct inventory, which is the sex inventory. And I was amazed. I was amazed. I had spent years playing the victim. I'm a very good victim. Very good. And looking at that conduct inventory really showed me a lot of things. You know, not only was I not a victim anymore, I had used every single, you know, man in my life. It didn't matter if we were in a serious relationship or not. In some shape, I used them. And that was pretty cool to see that. And I remember going over that, the fourth step with my sponsor during the fifth step. And there was one thing on there. It wasn't too bad. It wasn't too bad, but it was a little embarrassing. And I didn't want to tell her. So I was going to leave it off. And I just kind of skipped over. And she said, well, is there anything else that you need to tell me? I said, yeah. I guess so. And, you know, and I told her. And she said, well, that's nothing. I still think like that sometimes today. And I said, oof. Thank God. Thank God. And I remember, you know, we briefly talked about the sixth and seventh step, and she told me that I would need to go home and spend an hour and go over, you know, the first four or five steps and make sure I hadn't skimped on anything, and do the seventh step prayer. And I didn't. I didn't do that. And I didn't do it for a few days. And I remember calling a friend, freaking out, crying, feeling like such a horrible person. I just did my fourth and fifth step. You know, I'm supposed to feel like a new person. Why don't I? And they asked me why, you know, had I done a seven-step prayer. And I said, no, why? Because that's kind of important, apparently. And, you know, now I stress that, you know, to the women I sponsor, that it's really important to go home and sit for that hour or so and really think about what you've done and what you've seen and, you know, are you ready? And I was ready by that time. You know, so we did 8 and 9. 8 and 9 was a pretty cool experience. You know, I don't know if I had any expectations, maybe a little bit. But I think the first person I made amends to was my sister. She was in the program at the time, and I thought she'd be really easy. So I wanted to get her out of the way first. And I, you know, I think I called her up at that point. And I said, you know, I'm really sorry. This is what I've done. I want to make it right. What can I do? And she told me some things that I had left out that she had what I'd done. And you know, she's always been very vocal, and I listened. I listened to what she said, and she said, really, I just want to be a part of your life. I want you to let me in. And so, you know, I've tried to do that. She's still been in and out of the program a little bit, and she ended up relapsing at about 3 years sober, and that was really, really difficult for me. And it still is, because she's still not doing what I want her to do. She's not drinking, but she's not doing my program, you know, what I think she should do. But, you know, it's been interesting. You know, I'm trying to be there for her and trying to keep my mouth shut, which is always really hard. You know, I did my mom, and that was a really great experience. You know, she's my mom. She just wants me to be happy. She didn't have anything that she really wanted me to do to make amends. So I kind of had to make some stuff up. You know, I asked her, you know, can I do anything around the house? What can I do for you? You know, how can I make right what I've done wrong? And she said, nothing, you know, everything's great. I just want you to be happy. And I'm like, no, I really need to do something. Like, do something to make it right. You know, and with her, I've tried to let her in too. You know, I've tried to be there for her when she needs to talk or if she needs something done around the house. And I try to do what I can for her. And for my father, when I first got sober, I wrote him a letter and told him, you know, that I had stopped drinking and doing drugs. And I got a card back saying, you know, I'm really glad that you stopped smoking pot because that's really bad for you. He didn't say anything about the drinking. You know, him being an alcoholic, it's probably a scary thing for his baby girl to be in AA and sober. You know, for the next year or so, I tried to call him several times, left messages, never got anything back from him. And at the time, you know, when it came time to make amends, I couldn't really get a hold of him. You know, the cell phone number that I had didn't work anymore. So my sponsor and I decided that, you know, once a month at least, I would write him and tell him what was going on in my life. And I've been doing that for probably a year, year and a half now. And, you know, for a long time I didn't hear anything, never got any calls. I got a birthday card one year and he spelled my name wrong. That was really, I don't know, because he's a smart ass, so he might have done that on purpose. I don't know. But, you know, I keeping him up to date and letting him know what's going on. And about a week ago I got a Valentine's Day card from him, which I haven't gotten one in, like, probably 10 years, close to 10 years. And he spelled my name right. And, you know, it was just, it was the sweetest thing that he had done in a really long time. And, you know, and he wrote a little note in there, and he said, I'm really, you know, I'm glad to hear from you. Please keep the letters coming. And, you know, he wanted to know about my life. He asked me questions about, you know, where I'm living now. Are you still not smoking? I quit smoking about 8 months ago. And, you know, and he's gotten all the letters and he's read them. Wow, that's great. You know, and that was, I mean, that was great. You know, my sponsor always told me, you know, it's going to pay off. You just have to be patient. And I never knew, you know, if I waited that it would be a payoff. You know, 10, 11, and 12 are the living stuff, what I do try to do on a daily basis to stay sober. I don't always do them perfectly, but I do know when I don't do them on a daily basis, things go a little crazy. You know, the 10-step inventory, I take a look at my day and how I've been, and have I hurt anybody, was I resentful, dishonest, selfish, and I try and do that and catch the things before I have to take it to a more thorough inventory. Step 11, prayer and meditation. First of all, I can't sit still for more than a minute or two. So that's very difficult for me. Sometimes I try on the way to work to turn the radio off and just, you know, just have silence. And I was talking on the way here. This has really been freaking me out lately. I've been trying to pray in the morning, and I'll get, like, halfway through the third step prayer, and I'll forget where I was or what I'm doing. So I'll have to, like, start over, and I end up starting over, like, three or four times. But I'm not alone in that, apparently. Other people do that, too. But, you know, it's funny. When I am in trouble, that's when I spend the most time in prayer and meditation. You know, and very recently I've had some situations. I didn't get something that I wanted, that I really wanted, that I felt I deserved. I mean, I really deserve this. God just didn't know what he was doing. You know, I had other plans. But I didn't get what I wanted, and that in turn caused me a lot of pain, of course. And I had to sit down and do some inventory, you know, do some really thorough inventory. And it was funny. I mean, I never knew I had so much to write about this subject, you know. And I wrote a good deal. And again, you know, it was some conduct inventory. And again, I was disgusted at what I saw. You know, I had been lying to myself for, I mean, even through sobriety. You know, I had not been honest with myself. I had not been honest with people around me. And I had no idea, you know. And I did that, and I went over it with my sponsor, and I saw everything, and I was ready to change again. You know, that change of perception that only comes with a little bit of pain for me. And, you know, and during that time, I spent a lot of time in prayer, a lot of time thinking, talking to God, and just being willing. I was broken again, you know. The 12th step, working with others, practicing the principles in all our affairs. Really not good at practicing the principles in all my affairs, especially at home or at work. The people I spend the most time with, usually that's where my character defects come out. I'm practicing keeping my mouth shut. It's going okay. but it's... you know, that, I mean, working with other people, working with women, has probably been the bright spot in my life. You know, I never, you know, at a year, 9 months, a year sober, I didn't have anything to give anybody. You know, I didn't understand why I had to work with somebody else. and my friends and my sponsor stressed it, you know. And that has been amazing to get, you know, first of all, it's helped me with relationships with women. You know, it's helped me open up with women. And seeing them change and grow, seeing the light come back in their eyes, seeing them get it, you know, that is awesome. It's amazing. You know, and step 12 to me, it doesn't mean just working with other women or other alcoholics. It can be helping anybody. You know, like at work, I try not to stay in just my job description. I try and do things outside that little box. And, you know, helping my mom, helping my friends, and really doing, you know, service for AA, too. You know, I have a service position in my home group. I'm the treasurer. They trust me with money. I was a little nervous about that, but I think I've gotten the hang of it. I'm usually over by like $3 or $4, though, so that's better than being under. That's what I think, anyways. You know, and I have a service position outside of my home group. I recently got involved, I think about 7 or 8 months ago, with the treatment facilities committee in my area. And by luck, I guess, the chair ended up having to step down, and I got voted in. I don't know. And that's been kind of scary. It's different. You know, I've been on a committee before. We did the Young People's Conference in Virginia Beach last year, and that was awesome. But we had a little help with that. You know, we had an idea of what to look for, what we needed to do, that kind of thing. And with this, I've just kind of been thrown in, and the last 2 or 3 chairs didn't make it longer than 6 months. So that's been really neat. You know, the previous chair that lasted, I think he got 2 years. In the committee, he's really been helping me out with that, and that's been awesome. So, you know, it's just, I keep thinking, you know, I've got almost 3 years sober. I'm supposed to look like this, or I'm supposed to act like this. I'm supposed to be doing this by now. But that's not how it is. You know, I cannot compare my sobriety to somebody else's. I cannot compare my sobriety to my idea, my definition. You know, I have this definition of everything, you know, of what my life is supposed to look like, what I'm supposed to look like, what my program is, you know, what work, what I'm supposed to be doing in work, my idea of God, all these old ideas, you know, and they keep getting smashed, you know, just by experience, just by sticking around. You know, my idea of God has changed so much over the last couple of years, you know, and it keeps changing. And that's the beauty of Alcoholics Anonymous. There's not, like, levels. You don't ever graduate. You know, it's just, it's a learning experience every single day. And I am so grateful for Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm so grateful for the program, for the steps, for my sponsor, and God, you know. He's done so much for me. And I never knew I was worth anything until I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. So that's all I have. Thank you.